You're listening to The Globalists, first broadcast on the 11th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. On the show ahead, Iran has threatened to retaliate against Israel. But is this just rhetoric? We'll examine the possibility of an escalation of hostilities in the Middle East. In South Korea, 44 million voters had the opportunity to vote for the 300-member parliament yesterday. But it's really all about the leader. We'll get the results and look at what they mean for the future of the country. Then,
well, we'll look at the EU, which hopes it's finally got a deal on migration, Saudi Arabia's long, thin city, which is being cut short, and whether Poland is right to ban school homework.
Terry Stiassny back a little bit later with a look at the papers. We'll consult our own oracle in Delphi as we catch up with Andrew Muller and ask him to predict what will be happening at the Economic Forum there today. Plus, we look at the new Nations in Transit report, which measures progress and setbacks in the democratic process in over 29 countries.
Pretty soon, I think a lot of these countries, not just Serbia, but countries that we call hybrid regimes, which are sort of stuck between the poles of democracy and autocracy, they're going to have to start to make choices.
We'll have a roundup of theatre news. And finally, we'll discuss whales and dolphins and why they should receive legal person status. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. US President Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida have unveiled plans for military cooperation and projects ranging from missiles to moon landings, strengthening their alliance with an eye on countering China and Russia. German airline Lufthansa said yesterday it has suspended flights to Tehran due to the situation in the Middle East, which is on alert for possible Iranian retaliation for a suspected Israeli airstrike on Iran's embassy in Syria. More on that story in a moment. And some 200 Myanmar military personnel withdrew to a bridge connecting a border town with Thailand today, following a days-long assault in the area by anti-junta rebels. On Wednesday, Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei addressed a crowd of thousands in Tehran, condemning Israel and the West over crimes in Gaza during Ramadan and promising retaliation for the attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria. Top Iranian military and government officials have repeatedly warned of retaliation since the April 1st Israeli airstrike in Damascus, which killed the commanders of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Syria and Lebanon. But what form might retaliation take, and how would Israel respond? US and Israeli forces in the region have been put on high alert in the days since, and the US president has promised his ironclad support in the case of a move by Iran. Well, I'm joined now by Bill Law, who's a Middle East analyst and the editor of Arab Digest. Bill, what exactly did Khamenei say?
Khamenei said that the attack on the embassy in Damascus was an attack on Iranian soil, and he said that that is an act of war, and he threatened very deep repercussions for Israel. Now, what will those repercussions take? The last thing that Iran wants is to engage in a war with Israel, because they know that is a war they would not win. And President Biden giving that ironclad guarantee just a day after he had said that he disagreed with Netanyahu about the approach to an attack in Rafah, that he was outraged by the killing of seven aid workers. He's come back and given Netanyahu what he needs. This is a situation where if it was a chess game, there are moves going on. Unfortunately, this is a chess game with profound implications, most importantly right now for the Palestinian people, but also for the wider region. Mm. If Netanyahu can lure Iran into an attack, he's got that ironclad guarantee. Netanyahu does not want this war to end, And he's doing everything in his power to prevent that happening. He doesn't want a ceasefire because he knows once a ceasefire begins and there'll be pressure for a permanent ceasefire, he needs to keep the war going for his own political survival. And if you look at the targeted killing of the three sons and the four grandchildren of the leader of Hamas, a political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, just yesterday in Gaza, that was a targeted strike. And it was also a message. And when the Israelis want to carpet bomb in Gaza, they carpet bomb. When they want to target strike, they target strike. So we're in this place now where things could escalate. What keeps things in check is Iran's fear of a major confrontation, primarily with America. Now, on the other hand, there are hardliners in Iran, in Tehran, who see America as the great devil and, would perhaps want to confront America in some sort of an action. I think that, we're in this place where we just don't know what happens next. There could be cyber attacks from the Iranians. They could use Hezbollah. And of course, Lebanon is in a very perilous situation right now, both economically and politically, as well as, the military situation there is quite dangerous. And so, here we are. And as I said, Netanyahu is very skilled with this game, and he plays it ruthlessly. And he's got the backing of Benny Gantz, who's his political rival. Gantz said yesterday that kids who are in middle school now will be fighting in Gaza. They'll be fighting in Judea and Samaria, which is how the Israelis describe the West Bank. They'll be fighting in Lebanon.
I'd like to bring in Lizzie Porter now. She's a Middle East correspondent based in Istanbul. Lizzie, do you think these threats of retaliation are just more of the same tired rhetoric, or is Iran serious?
They're serious to a certain extent in that they need to do something. Khamenei needs to send a message internally that he, in order to save face, in order to show his electorate and his support base and the Iranian public that he is not going to allow Israeli attacks on senior IRGC and Iranian officials to go unanswered. On the other hand, as Bill mentioned, getting into a direct conflict with Israel is something that they want to avoid because they wouldn't be able to win it. It would be devastating for Iran and the region. And that is not an easy conflict to get out of. And they know that. So in the past, we have seen indirect responses to such attacks, either through the militant group Proxy and Ally Network in Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria. One example, a recent example, was a strike on Iraqi Kurdistan after Israeli attacks again on IRGC commanders in Syria. Iran attacked what it claims are Israeli bases in Iraqi Kurdistan. That was vehemently denied by Iraqi officials, but it was a strike and a deadly strike on Iraqi Kurdistan that allowed Iran to say, look, we have retaliated for Israeli aggressions and attacks on us without the risk of further counterattacks and escalation, because it's a geographically close and relatively relative weak point in that it is not going to, it's not going to elicit a direct Israeli or US counter response. So maybe, I never like to make predictions, but there will likely be some sort of response, but getting into a kind of direct war with Israel is something that the Iranians will want to avoid.
Bill, I wonder how the wider Middle East, Saudi Arabia in particular, would view any kind of escalation.
Saudi Arabia is very, very keen to avoid any escalation. In fact, if you look at what's happened with the Houthis hitting shipping in the Red Sea, the Saudis have been very quiet about that, which has upset the Americans because they would like to see the Saudis step up and be more vigorous in denouncing the Houthi attacks, but the Saudis want to get out of Yemen, and they were just at a point where they'd almost got a peace deal done when the Houthis started to hit Red Sea shipping. This was just around the post October 7th attack by Hamas. So the Saudis will be urging de-escalation. The Emiratis will also, because the Emiratis have diplomatic relations with the Israelis, they will be talking de-escalation. The whole region is very, very nervous about a major conflict erupting. And I think if you go beyond the Gulf, if you look at, I mentioned Lebanon, that's very, very fragile. If you look at Syria, the Syrians, you know, the situation with Bashar Assad and the Israelis is Bashar Assad effectively said, look, when you want to take out, you know, some IRGC folks, when you want to hit some arms that are coming in, you go ahead and do it. I'm not going to intervene. But when the Israelis hit that embassy, that again ups the ante. What helps Netanyahu is when, for example, Lord Cameron says, I've taken legal advice, we will not suspend our arms shipments to the Israelis because we're not in violation of international law. Netanyahu takes that as a signal. He can proceed. He can continue to play this chess game, this very, you know, dangerous chess game. So I think the whole region is kind of holding their breath and waiting to see what happens next.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. That's Bill Law there. And we also heard from Lizzie Porter. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 15:12 in Seoul, 7:12 here in London. Yesterday, South Korea's first general election since Yoon Suk-yeol won the presidency in 2022 took place. Back then, he beat Lee Jae-myung of the Democratic Party by a tiny margin. Now, it looks as if Lee has won a resounding victory. But for these two leaders, the political is personal. Well, I'm joined now by Joon Ha Park, who's a reporter at NK News. What are the results, Joon?
Hi, thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure to be joining you from Seoul. Just to start with, the results were finalized Thursday morning, Seoul time, to be quite a significant victory, as you said, Georgina, for the main opposition Democratic Party, and a resounding defeat for the ruling People Power Party and President Yoon Suk-yeol. When factoring in proportional representation, the DP, the Democratic Party, alongside its satellite party, solidified 175 seats, while the PPP, the People Power Party, along with its satellite party, attained 108 seats in the 300-member National Assembly, making the Yoon administration the first in South Korean constitutional history to face a majority opposition in parliament for the entirety of his five-year term.
As you say, it's about 300 seats in parliament. Why then have these elections been referred to as gladiator politics? What is the history of the rivalry between Yoon and Lee?
So Yoon and Lee's rivalry basically started or came into fruition during the 2022 presidential election when the two were pitted against each other. There was quite a holistic divide between Lee's supporters, who were mainly made up of a younger female representation, as well as voters in their 40s and 50s, while Yoon's conservative party and conservative policies, which focus mostly on men's rights, barring women's rights, was supported by younger males and also the older generation. So that has continued Lee became the leader of the Democratic Party soon after Yoon's inauguration into the presidency, and he has continued his fight against Yoon's policies since May 2022.
And I mean, there's all sorts of threats of legal action and the idea that there might be an impeachment and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so right now, as of the numbers that we can see right now, in order to successfully go through with a impeachment and also nullify the president's vetoes of bills that he has done in the past, right now, with the numbers that the Democratic Party has, along with the Rebuilding Korea Party, the led by the former Justice Minister Cho Guk, you need 200 seats for an impeachment. So right now, an impeachment is not possible unless you can have support from the Conservatives, which right now does not look politically likely for Lee and the Democratic Party and the wider opposition bloc.
Mm. I'd like to just stay with numbers for a moment and have a look at the turnout, because it was startlingly high. And I wonder what was driving that, what the main concerns of the electorate were.
Well, just to build on from the numbers, so the voter turnout for this election was the highest ever recorded in 32 years. The last highest one was at 71%, 71.7%, my apologies, in 1992. It stood at 67% as of 6 p.m. yesterday, according to South Korea's National Election Commission. So that percentage surpasses that of the previous parliamentary elections in 2020, which saw 66.2% of voters cast their ballots amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. To answer your second question about how those numbers can be explained, well, the recent election was a response, direct response, to the seismic unhappiness with the current Yoon Suk-yeol administration from the general public, as can be seen by the results. So the president and the ruling party have faced quite fluctuating public approval, with the general election kind of seen as a midterm assessment of Yoon's leadership going forward. He has 3 years left in his term, so the elections that just happened are a wider reflection of the growing public sentiment and the quite negative consensus that is going on against the Yoon administration.
And I wonder how much power he will have then until the end of his term, because, I mean, does he then become a lame duck president? And does that also affect foreign policy? Will it have immediate impact on his efforts to expand security cooperation with Washington and Tokyo, for instance?
Well, just to answer your first question there, so yes, he will. This election result does offer a significant blow to Yoon's reform policies domestically, in the sense that the Democratic Party, along with the Rebuilding Korea Party and the major opposition party bloc, can block his bills from going to concession. Also, in terms of foreign policy, right now, on the basis of the current inter-Korean frosty relations, I don't believe that the current National Assembly will have a large effect on foreign policy, as foreign policy was not exactly a major issue that voters took to their polling stations as the elections were unfolding yesterday.
Mm. And many analysts say that the election has amplified polarization in the country. Why do you think it's so divided?
Well, mostly because since taking office, and this goes for both sides, President Yoon, I'll first explain why it's so for President Yoon. So President Yoon, he has been accused of authoritarian tendencies. He's branded his political opponents as communists and attacked the media as purveyors of fake news. And whenever a media outlet would print information or a news article that goes against him and his administration, and is also pursuing defamation cases against critical journalists. He's also faced criticism for stoking gender divisions and attempting to abolish the government's gender equality ministry. I might add that also the position of gender minister of South Korea right now is currently vacant, despite lacking the parliamentary support for the complete abolishment of the gender equality ministry. And he's also avoided compromise with the opposition, frequently using his presidential veto to block legislation regarding a probe into the government's handling of the 2022 Itaewon disaster, which took more than 100 young lives, and a probe into the scandals surrounding the First Lady. And he's earned a reputation for prioritizing his beliefs over his presidential approval rates and his popularity. On the other side of the political aisle, Lee's domestic campaign against Yoon has also fared mostly onto polarization. Most of the experts that I've been speaking to here have said that both sides are at fault, mostly because Lee and also the Democratic Party have continued campaigns against Yoon's major domestic policies and also foreign policies as well, mostly domestic policies. And I think that the polarization is still yet to continue with the huge opposition bloc that was confirmed today morning.
June, thank you very much indeed. That's June Ha Park speaking to us from Seoul. Now, still to come on the programme, what pushes a country into autocracy and what can be done to revert the trend?
It's always a combination of factors. There are local trajectories and local leaders that are looking to centralize power and seem to be, frankly, increasingly willing to go to any ends to do so. But at the same time, this geopolitical moment where democracies haven't stepped up to the plate to defend their order and to defend their liberal values as much as they could be.
This is The Globalist. Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is the author and political journalist, Terry Stiastny. Good morning to you, Terry.
Good morning.
We are looking at the EU. This is from some German papers, but it's widely reported. The EU deciding on tougher migration rules.
Well, yes, that's right. So both in the Times in London and in Die Zeit in Germany, people are talking about the European Parliament, which has just after long negotiations and discussions come to a deal on migration and asylum. And this, you know, the Times describes this as a 2 billion euro reform of migrant laws. And the German papers are describing this as a sort of stiffening of the asylum rules. And it's been, you know, really controversial. So this big plan, and it's taken a lot of negotiation, and still everybody is not entirely happy with it. I mean, the German government seems pretty happy with it. Other countries much less so. And the main contention here is it's, you know, as the situation was, when migrants arrived in Europe, they were supposed to apply for asylum in the first country that they landed in. And many countries felt that that put a sort of disproportionate pressure on countries like Italy and Greece, for instance, where obviously a lot of migrants, particularly coming across the Mediterranean, were landing. And they're sort of saying we need to have a way to share the burden more equally. Though, of course, there are some countries being reported here, for instance, Hungary and Poland, neither of them are particularly happy with it. And they're saying, well, we don't want to take on the migrants who are being sort of shipped on to us from other countries. But countries like Italy and Germany are saying, well, you know, this is not ideal. And there have been a lot of people saying these new rules are too harsh. But Italy saying that this is the best possible compromise, and other countries saying, well, you know, it may not be great, but this is the best deal that we're going to get.
And I mean, as the Times points out, it's not really expected to satisfy either side of the migration debate.
Well, yeah, this is the problem. I mean, even during the meeting of the European Parliament, which was agreeing this, there were protesters, there were people saying that this would cost lives, there were people, particularly on the left, you know, even people, someone from the centre left, there's a Dutch MEP quoted here saying absolutely no one will be popping a bottle of champagne this evening. And some people, the European Parliament's left bloc, saying this is a dark day for human rights. the fight for a humane migration policy does not end here. So yes, although this has gone through and it still needs to be decided on by the Council of Ministers, but you know, because the European Parliament has voted for it, that's, you know, now likely to happen. Not everybody is happy by any means, and you know, still large numbers of asylum applications in the EU last year, one of the highest years since 2015, and when this was a crisis. But of course, you've got to look at this in the context of, you've got big EU elections coming up in June, and you know, every country is kind of looking at this and thinking, well, this might be, you know, a big issue come the European elections, and they want to be seen to be trying to do something about it.
Mm. Let's go to Saudi Arabia now, because the Crown Prince's pet project is meant to be this 105-mile-long city. But despite its wealth, finances are going to curtail this, it looks.
Yes, this is reported in The Guardian, I think was also initially reported on Bloomberg. And I hadn't been, perhaps I should have been aware of this, but it's just, the idea of this city is so bizarre. And the images of it, you know, assume sort of AI-generated plans. And they do look like something out of, you know, sort of Blade Runner in the desert. And this is a city which is supposed to be called The Line. It's supposed to be 170 kilometres long, but only a few metres wide. So just a long, long, long sort of mirrored city running
like
through the
mile.
Desert. Well, like, I think it's, you know, it's pitched as a reinvention of urban design, and it's supposed to be, you know, something. I'm not sure how it would have worked, but only a few hundred metres wide and sort of hundreds of kilometres long. Ideally, it's supposed to be home to about 9 million people. But this is being scaled back, and apparently is only going to be, you know, a couple of kilometres long by 2030. And so I think, you know, this is obviously interesting because looking at, you know, where does Saudi Arabia positioning itself, is trying to have this idea of a cognitive city, a civilization revolution. It would be powered by artificial intelligence, you know, sort of a real kind of space age city in the middle of the desert. But a lot of people and investors are clearly not entirely convinced that this city was going to be everything that it promised to be.
Yeah, perhaps the research wasn't done properly. As in Poland, where, in fact, homework is something that they want completely off the table.
But I thought this is a really interesting discussion here in the Financial Times. And Poland has decided, the Polish government has decided to reform the education system. And one of the things that they are doing, as well as having a 30% pay rise for teachers, they're changing the syllabus in terms of education, having less religious education. And one of the things they're saying is, children don't need to do so much homework. And obviously, you know, a lot of, there's a Polish 7-year-old who is absolutely thrilled about this, saying, she, you know, her class is very happy, her homework is too difficult, and she's looking forward to going outside and playing. But the argument behind this, which is, you know, just quite interesting in for every country, is one of the things they're saying, that actually children who do more homework get lower grades, which seems sort of completely counterintuitive, which seems strange to me. You know, so I'm sort of one of those sitting there, don't do your homework, it's very important, you need to be doing that. But there are also arguments that children have been using ChatGPT to write their homework, so it's not actually been very effective. And also suggesting that children who doing homework, it's inequality, because the children in affluent families are helped by their parents, or they have private tutors, they have other people to help them with it. But so this is becoming, you know, a big debate, not only in Poland, but I can imagine in other countries as well, picking up on this.
Yeah. And of course, one of the notable things about the Polish education system is the fact that they've had to cope with many, many refugees coming in from Ukraine, which has been really changing the way that schools operate.
Well, yes. And I think, you know, they are saying that, you know, children in Poland have had too much homework in the past. They said they've had more than, you know, nearly 2 hours a night, compared with an average in the OECD countries of an hour and a half. And I think they will still be allowed to do homework. Teachers will be allowed to set it, but they won't be able to grade it. But I think there's a question about how much do children, you know, just be taught in school, and how much they need to learn on their own initiative, or just have that repetition, get the word right, of, yes, I need to do my homework, of doing things more effectively and working by themselves rather than just working in class and being told what to do.
And finally, I mean, you'd think that Westminster had enough sex scandals at present, what with RAG and the honey traps thing and so on. But we're now dragging up a scandal from the days of Harold Wilson.
Well, yes, if I say, you know, the Times were sort of teasing readers yesterday, going big bombshell revelations, you know, and when they're saying revelations of an affair in Downing Street... this was an affair that happened 50 years ago, but it's an interesting little historical sidelight. So Harold Wilson, in his last days in office, he was in quite a bad state. You know, he was drinking a lot. He was eventually going to resign because his sort of mental faculties was getting the beginnings of dementia. But it turns out that he was also having an affair, but not with the person that everybody for about the last 50 years has assumed that he was having an affair with, although that was strenuously denied, with Marcia Williams, his very close colleague who worked with him all the time. He was actually having an affair with somebody else, a woman called Janet Hewlett Davis, who was the deputy press secretary. And now his colleagues, who've always written about this in the past, this is their one last secret that they were apparently holding on to and now wanted to reveal before the press secretary, in his last years. He's 96 years old and has now revealed this story and saying he discovered this when the woman was going upstairs to the Downing Street Prime Minister's room and kind of wondered why his junior was going upstairs to the Prime Minister's room. And he has now discovered this. So, you know, plus ça change, lots of affairs over history in British politics.
Absolutely. Terry, thank you very much indeed. That's Terry Stiastony. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. German airline Lufthansa said yesterday it had suspended flights to Tehran due to the situation in the Middle East, which is on alert for possible Iranian retaliation for a suspected Israeli airstrike on Iran's embassy in Syria. Some 200 Myanmar military personnel withdrew to a bridge connecting a border town with Thailand today, following a days-long assault in the area by anti-junta rebels. Myanmar's military-run government is battling armed rebel groups on several fronts and has suffered a string of defeats in frontier areas. And US President Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida have unveiled plans for military cooperation and projects ranging from missiles to moon landings, strengthening their alliance with an eye on countering China and Russia. A joint news conference at the White House reflected the growing importance of Japan on the world stage and to the United States, as the two leaders weighed in on Gaza and Israel, Ukraine and Russia, North Korea and other world flashpoints. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. ...2024 has been dubbed the year of elections around the world, and yet democracy as a concept has been on the back foot. Nowhere is this more clear than in the annual Nations in Transit report by Freedom House, which looks at 29 countries from Central Europe to Central Asia and how they've tried to shift from autocracy to democracy since the fall of the Soviet Union. Monocle's Chris Chermak spoke to Alexandra Karpi, the co-author of this year's report, and began by asking what surprised her about this year's edition.
For the 20th consecutive year, democratic governance declined in our region of coverage. Think about that for a second. That means that for two straight decades, we've seen more countries have worsening conditions for democratic governance compared to those that improved conditions. Should be, I think, a wake-up call for European democracies and supporters of democracy everywhere, frankly. But what is new, in a sense, when you look at events in 2023, which the report covers, is that we're now talking about, in this region, two opposing camps of pro- and anti-democracy countries, right? So we're talking about democracies that have made slow but steady progress to build resilient institutions on one sort of side of the continent. And then on the other side, we have an increasingly authoritarian, violent, and repressive group of countries that have only made gains, it seems, over the last 20 years. So we're now talking orders that, frankly, if democratic governments and supporters of democracy don't act now, it's going to be increasingly difficult for the kind of pro-democracy camp, if you will, to reverse those gains.
I was wondering to what extent you feel like that is motivated by alliances, those countries that are tying themselves increasingly to Russia and China, say, or on the other side, the European Union and the West? And to what extent is it motivated by the leaders themselves?
You know, before there were those kinds of relationships that you've mentioned, there were worsening human rights conditions and the capture of would-be democratic institutions, frankly, over time. So on the one hand, this is driven largely by local development specific to each of these countries. And that's, I think, a really core part of our report is making sure we track those local contexts and developments over time. But at the same time, you're very right to point out to those relationships that have developed. We are seeing increasingly like-minded allies, and we are starting to see cooperation, not just in joint investment or in the energy sector, right? The report calls attention to not only Russia and China, but Azerbaijan going to Turkey or to Iran in their conquest of Nagorno-Karabakh in 2023. Certainly, Russia has to look quite further afield for support in its ongoing authoritarian aggression in Ukraine. And that's real, you know, military examples, but there's also, I think, definitely a sort of authoritarian playbook being passed around right now. We saw in 2023, but also at the start of this year, the copy and pasting of Russian-style legislation continuing, especially in Central Asia, in Kyrgyzstan, where we just had a foreign agent-style law passed. So to answer your question, it's always a combination of factors. There are local trajectories and local leaders that are looking to centralize power and seem to be, frankly, increasingly willing to go to any ends to do so. But at the same time, this geopolitical moment where democracies haven't stepped up to the plate to defend their order and to defend their liberal values as much as they could be. So it is partially the geopolitical moment, but also local trajectories.
Now, one country I wanted to ask you about specifically is one that had the largest decline, and that is Serbia, which stands out also among Balkan states. So I was wondering how you explain Serbia's decline yourself. Isn't an example of the kind of waning influence of the European Union that they have not leaned towards democracy and instead towards, well, frankly, Russia?
Yeah, Serbia is in some ways a unique case in the Western Balkans, but also being, you know, the largest country, the largest economy also sets the tone for the region. And it's unique in the sense that it is certainly leaning in a more autocratic direction. And that was really laid bare in 2023. Ultimately, we had right at the end of the year fraudulent local and parliamentary elections that, again, really exposed the extent of media capture by this ruling party and dominance by Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić in the media. We also saw how municipal governments and mayors have just been essentially totally captured to the ruling party and to national authorities. And this is on top of multiple years of waning judicial independence and the politicization of court decisions under this kind of frozen judicial reform that's been promised now for several years. So when you take all that together, you're going to see the kind of steep drop in our ratings that Serbia experienced. But to kind of get to this question about the EU, some of that is fully a local story, right? To understand Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić and his government, it seems that the main prerogative is to centralize power. He has done that by pursuing relationships not just with Russia, but with Hungary and with others, and has also become a bit of a regional playmaker, right? He's sort of the security guarantor for this region when it comes to, you know, the EU's dealings with it, et cetera. And so he plays, I think, a unique role as a leader in this region. And part of what allows him to do that is obviously having support at home. So he's balancing or juggling, perhaps is the better metaphor, a lot of balls right now. And it's going to become, I would say, increasingly difficult for him to manage all of those competing priorities as this region is reordering. You know, pretty soon, I think a lot of these countries, not just Serbia, but countries that we call hybrid regimes, which are sort of stuck between the poles of democracy and autocracy, they're going to have to start to make choices. And unfortunately, it seems like Serbia is starting to make a choice towards the autocracy camp.
To take one country that has maybe made that switch, Poland is this interesting case, as you highlight in the report, of a country whose path was towards democratic backsliding until recent elections, which I guess does show that this can also be sometimes extremely leader dependent. I wonder what Poland, for example, says about the power of leadership and how fragile is it?
Poland is in uncharted territory in a lot of ways. The extent of its democratic backsliding, almost in nearly a decade of backsliding under the former government, it's not going to be something that you can correct overnight, obviously. And frankly, when you're talking about that degree of decline, it's hard to see lessons learned or cases from other regions that apply perfectly. We do try and go through some of them in the report, you know, see if there's some lessons from Slovakia or Slovenia or Czechia that have also kind of had the swinging pendulum effect, this rotation of illiberal leaders. Indeed, those cases and the Polish case as well indicate that when you have literature breakthrough elections, it can be a moment to catalyze democratization and rebuild democratic institutions. The problem with Poland is that there is just so much overlapping decline to wade through. Much has been made about the rule of law crisis in Poland, and indeed that is the score in our reporting that has declined the most. On the other hand, you know, there are media issues to correct, right? Media independence issues with the public broadcaster that we already saw that the Polish government kind of falter in trying to respond to. There is now election abuse, election integrity to shore up after the most recent elections, because the outgoing party did everything in its power to stop this new opposition from coming in. So there are just so many overlapping institutional challenges to probably a degree we haven't really seen in this region before. So how this new leadership is going to be able to just approach that at all is an open question. You know, it's not just about new leadership coming in. It's also about can citizens and civil society support those efforts and make sure that the new government has buy-in from society, right, and has expert input to make sure that these really unprecedented reforms can be rolled back in a way that is fundamentally democratic. I mean, that is no easy feat.
That was Alexandra Karpi, co-author of the Freedom House's Nations in Transit report, speaking to our Chris Chermak. You're with Monocle Radio. It is 7:39 here in London. That's 9:39 in Delphi, where the annual Delphi Economic Forum is currently underway. Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller, is there for us. He joins me now on the line from Greece. Good morning to you, Andrew.
Good morning, Georgina.
Today is when you swap from being a media observer to a participant. You're on the stage. What are you going to be doing?
I'm doing two things today. I am chairing what they're calling a fireside chat, but it's not really the weather for firesides here, with Nusrat Ghani, the UK's Minister of State for Europe. She obviously was an enthusiastic Brexiter, so I'm not quite sure how she's going to square that part of her history with her current role and in this environment where I think people are still no less bewildered by Brexit than they were 8 years ago when it happened. And I'll also be convening a panel a bit later on discussing the eternal question, at least here in the east of the continent, of whether Germany will ever get over itself and participate fully in the defence of the continent.
What other talks are happening?
It is extremely varied. There is a lot on this year, much more than last year, about AI and what kind of difference that is going to make to literally everything. Obviously, Greece being Greece, there is a great deal of chat about shipping. Yesterday was mostly when as we discussed on yesterday's show, when the big hitters turned up. Today is a bit more disparate and a bit more spread out. And we'll be interviewing for forthcoming shows various think tank types, at least one former US general, and various others to be confirmed.
Mm-hmm. And who have you been speaking to? Because I know you've been recording a lot of interviews.
We have. Yesterday we spoke to the president of Slovenia, as we discussed on yesterday's briefing, after which we spoke to Stefan Löfven, who was, until quite recently, for many years, prime minister of Sweden. He's now president of the European Socialists. He was interesting on the subject of the imminent EU elections, which obviously are also a cause for considerable concern hereabouts, given the polling of the far right across Europe. They are anticipated to finish first in at least 9 European countries. He is now president of the European Socialists, as I was saying, and he still does think, and it was kind of stirring to hear it, that the populists need to be stood up to, despite the fact that when the European Socialists threw out the two Slovakian parties of the prime minister and the president-elect, they had a massive dent in their polling numbers. He is aware of the contradiction that when you take the populists on, you do tend to rather entrench their narrative as the put-upon thwarted sentinels of the common folk.
Mm. Andrew, would you say that this summit is just another talking shop, or is it a highly useful event?
It's both of those things. I think it is a highly useful event because of where it is. And, you know, Greece is obviously wedged in between Turkey, the Balkans and the Mediterranean Sea, which is going to become, well, it always has been, but is going to become even more so a considerable diplomatic and economic frontline. And we are in a part of the world in which events in Ukraine do seem very real. We also spoke yesterday to Roxandra Ivan, who's an advisor on European matters to the current Prime Minister of Romania. She did talk about the idea that events in Ukraine have started to cause the center of Europe's power to move eastwards, because it is the countries in the east that realize that we are the ones who are forever going to be saddled with the responsibility for defending this continent. She did say, while being well aware of you know, it's a difficult thing to say, but there is an opportunity here for Eastern Europe to actually step up, take its full part in the continent and demand to be taken seriously as it does so.
Absolutely. Andrew, I have to say, I don't have much sympathy for her, but I do have to say Nusrat Ghani is probably not looking forward to her session today.
Well, let's just hope she's not listening, Georgina.
Andrew Muller, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It's time to talk theatre with Matt Wolff, theatre critic at the International New York Times. Good morning to you, Matt.
Good morning to you, Georgina.
At the Olivier Awards.
Yes, Sunday night.
Tell me more. Who's in contention?
It should be pretty exciting because there are a lot of very good races this year. Sometimes it feels a bit sort of yesterday's news, but this year, Guys and Dolls versus Sunset Boulevard for in the musical categories, in the play categories, Dear England versus The Motive in the Queue, Andrew Scott's Vanya up against Mark Gatiss's John Gielgud. Huh. There's some interesting competitions, and I have no idea which way it's going to go, but it should make for a fun evening. And Hannah Waddingham, who's hosted last year, and boy, is she good at this kind of thing. It's not an easy ask to host an industry kind of shebang, but she does it with style.
How important are the Olivier Awards?
Well, oddly, they seem to be more important in New York because everything in New York, particularly in the theater, is about awards. And I think people want to win Olivier so they can take their shows to Broadway. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, yeah. Let's have a look at what's on
sure.
at the moment, because it does seem right now to be dominated by high-profile women.
Yes, a lot of women, some of them doing incredible work in wonderful plays, others sort of being very valiant, even as the show they're in goes down with the ship, shall we say. An example of that, alas, is the wonderful Sheridan Smith, who may be possibly the most likable actress in the London Theatre, but she's tethered herself to this peculiar musical called Opening Night at the Gielgud Theatre, which is based on a cult movie from 1977 about an actress in meltdown, played by Sheridan Smith, who in her own life, as she has said many a time, has experienced meltdowns of her own. So you would think it's a perfect sort of synergy, but the show is so peculiar, and it's got a score by Rufus Wainwright, who is hugely talented, of course, but he's not a writer for the musical theatre. He just doesn't write musicals.
And of course, it's directed by Ivar von Hohn,
yes.
who's known for his sort of ultra-modern yes. minimalism, this kind of expressionist theatricality, if you like.
It's all beginning, and you know, nobody was a greater fan than I of earlier shows of his, like View from the Bridge with Mark Strong, which was incredible. But it's beginning to sort of ossify into shtick. You've got kind of the cameras roaming around, and you've got bits where the actors go outdoors onto the street, which happens with Sheridan in the second act. And the conceit with this is that a documentary film crew is filming the rehearsals for this catastrophic Broadway musical. Well, you think in real life, what catastrophic Broadway musical would want a documentary filmed about them. It makes no sense.
Let's have a look at our local theatre. That's Hampstead Theatre.
Yes, this is sort of a middling play. It's called The Divine Mrs. S, but it's got a lovely central performance by Rachel Sterling, better known, certainly the tabloid press, as the daughter of Dinah Rigg and so on. But she's a proper actress in her own right. In this, she plays Sarah Siddons, the legendary British actress. And it's very interesting, following on from The Motive in the Queue, which was about John Gielgud. There seems to be a great interest now in the British theatre, looking back at some of their own titans. But instead of acknowledging the male heavyweights, here's a female heavyweight. From a vanished era, she had a brother, played in the production by Dominic Rowan, who was an old-style bit of a ham. It's very tricky in the contemporary theatre to act a ham without seeming hammy. But Rachel Sterling does a wonderful job as sort of a woman discovering herself amidst a male-dominated milieu in which she emerged triumphant.
Now, Hampstead Theatre is a strange one because, of course, it's not the West End, is
no.
it? And there's been a bit of churn there in terms of personnel recently, but still really a very important venue in terms of theatre in
well,
this country.
Well, the big thing with the Hampstead was they lost all their funding, all their Arts Council funding about a year and a half ago or something. So now they're really having to make a go of it on the back of box office, so they're trying to get bigger names, well-known writers, and patronage, benefaction. It's becoming a lot like a New York theater, depending on local community and sort of, you know, support.
Mm. Let's finally look at the Wyndham's Theatre. And this is the production of Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night.
Well, this is a show, and it's always been a play not for the faint of heart. By that, I mean, it's the better part of 4 hours. It's pretty eviscerating. It takes place essentially in sort of one living room cramped quarters of the Tyrone family in Connecticut. And it's a play that O'Neill himself found so painful that he didn't want to produce until after his death, which indeed was the case. The star attraction here, I suppose, for British audiences is Brian Cox, fresh from Succession, of course, on television. But actually, the production is pretty much scuppered by the amazing American actress Patricia Clark, who plays Mary Tyrone, the morphine-addicted wife, who retreats into a haze of delusion and grief and very, very wounded as her husband, Brian Cox, and their two sons look on, unable to do anything except watch their mother or wife retreat from view. It's harrowing stuff, and she does it absolutely brilliantly.
And so it is said that the four main characters are semi-autobiographical.
Yes. Yes.
So this is O'Neill's family.
Oh, absolutely. And if you go to the Monte Cristo Cottage, which I recommend for people who might be near the Connecticut coast, you can see the actual location where the play is set. And it's quite interesting because claustrophobia is very important in the landscape of the play, physically and also emotionally. And when you're there, you feel it. Mary is an interesting character because she disappears for much of the second act. She's kind of pacing above on the floorboards. Her sons and husband are hearing her. They're wondering what's going on. And when you've been to the cottage, you can understand exactly what that's like. And what Patricia Clarkson does very well is make Mary vivid even when she isn't visible. You're always aware of her just as her family is.
What a great talent. What a great skill.
Yeah.
And finally, I know it's unfair, but we were talking about the Olivier Awards. Surely Guys and Dolls has got to get it.
Well, I loved it. I've seen it 4 times. I think there's a lot of wind behind Sunset Boulevard because people had slightly written that show off as connected originally to its set 30 years ago. Incredible John Napier levitating set. And what this production did was pretty much do away with all sets and focus entirely on the psychology of the characters. And it was pretty raw and almost dystopian, which is a weird word to use for Lloyd Webber. So, and it's going to Broadway in Triumph in the autumn. So we'll see. Either one is a worthy winner in my book.
Matt, thank you very much indeed. That's Matt Wolfe there. And this is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Now, Indigenous leaders in New Zealand, Tonga, French Polynesia and the Cook Islands have drawn up a document that recognises cetaceans as legal persons. Conservationists say granting personhood status is not about claiming that whales and dolphins are human, but recognising that they have rights, just as people do. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Lalene Paul. She's a novelist, a playwright, a screenwriter, and most recently the author of Pod, a cetacean epic, an imagined story based in real environmental science and marine biology. Lalene, it's really lovely to have you on the show. Why have the Indigenous leaders done this?
Good morning, Georgina. It's very exciting news to me because it shows that we protect what we love and we protect what we need to survive. And the so-called less developed nations are closer, probably, to those ancient beliefs which we are rediscovering about the validity of other ways of living, other life forms, and it's fascinating that cetaceans have been granted this personhood by the oceanic nations that stretch from Hawaii to New Zealand.
And what do you think those nations hope to achieve by having granted this status?
Well, I was thinking about this, and they see, for instance, in Hawaii, there's this wonderful word, ohana, which means family. And it extends not just to your immediate human family, but your community and beyond your community, the creatures with whom you share your world. And so it is a recognition that our world is so much bigger than our limited human life. And I think we are all having to, willingly or not, accept that in order to survive. Mm. And of course, there are some creatures it's easier to love than others. And the great charismatic megafauna are definitely in that category.
Now, in your wonderful book, Pod, which was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction last year, you explore the true meaning of family, of belonging, of sacrifice, the harmony and the tragedy of the pod. And you look at it within an ocean that's no longer the sanctuary that it once was, and which reflects a world that's all too recognisable as our own. And the world is recognisable as our own, but so too are the protagonists. And I wonder why you made the decision to call the all marine characters, two different dolphin species, whales, even different fish, people. I mean, clearly you have some sympathy with the idea of legal personhood for cetaceans then.
Yeah, it was a more intuitive decision, which then made the writing so much easier, because cetaceans, dolphins, whales, orcas, we know, are they're completely social animals. And they live in family groups, they live in pods, and to put them into solitary confinement is a terrible thing. And I did a lot of research on many cetacean species, and it became very apparent the parallels with human existence, with human social existence, were just so obvious. And scientists are very wary of using emotional words like love, for instance. Let's just go straight there. But we know that cetaceans grieve. We know that there is no other realistic explanation for how, for instance, they attend their dead. We have observed in hippos and elephants strange behavior about the death of a carp or the death of a herd member. And it really doesn't seem a stretch at all to give other species the ability to feel. Anyone with a pet will know this.
Absolutely. I wonder how your readers have reacted to this. I mean, the book has been tremendously popular.
Well, it's great because some people are, they love it, and other people have been furious with me for upsetting them about the facts that are in the book. So they are angry with me for making them confront the terrible state of our oceans and what we are doing to the creatures that we share this planet with. Mm. But then an amazing thing happens, which is some of them come back and say, I'm still really angry, but I'm now angry about the situation and I'm telling people to read this book.
Which is wonderful. I mean, do you think our connection to the natural world is getting better or worse?
Both, you know, the best of times and the worst of times. At the same time that we are celebrating, let's say, the declaration of personhood, which means the indivisible right of a living being to be recognized as such, we're also continuing in our less than merry way of intensive agriculture, animal farming, and the shocking fact of live export. And we still can separate our minds from animals that we want to look after and places in the world that we want to look after and things that we turn a blind eye to. And we are now at a stage of environmental degradation where we can no longer do that, and we have to wake up. And I think the oceanic nations, Costa Rica, who have recognized, is it bees? I think it is bees in Costa Rica.
And of course, that was your first book, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. Set in a beehive and based in real biology. And there's brilliant work being done at Imperial College on bee language. Bees have vocabulary. We don't yet know what it is. And there is amazing work being done in Dominica, the SETI project by Shane Giro, about a machine language studying the language of sperm whales. So the largest predator on Earth, the sperm whale, has a static population off the coast of Dominica, and it's being studied, but their language is being studied by AI. And it is quite possible, Georgina, that in our lifetime, we are going to have a breakthrough and be able to understand at least what this population of sperm whales might be saying.
Lillian, thank you so much. Lillian Paul, thanks for joining us on The Globalist. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvinney, Carlotta Ribello and Monica Lillis. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager, Tamsin Howard. After the headlines, there's more music on the way and The Briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.